Thank you for listening to Lost Ladies of Lit. For access to all of our bonus episodes and to help support the cause of recovering forgotten women writers, join our Patreon community. Visit lostladiesoflit.com and click Become a Patron to find out more.
Welcome to Lost Ladies of Lit, the podcast dedicated to unearthing forgotten classics by women writers. I'm Kim Askew, here with my co-host, Amy Helms.
Today, we're going to be discussing an Egyptian writer who wrote a single novel before tragically dying by suicide soon after it was rejected for publication.
Eniat Izayet's novel, Love and Silence, was eventually published in 1967, 4 years after her death, but then her name seemed to virtually disappear from literary history.
Fast forward 30 years to 1993, when poet and author Iman Mersal stumbled across the book in Cairo's oldest book market and purchased it for one Egyptian pound.
The novel haunted Mersal so much that in 2019, she wrote a biography on Izayet, in which she shares her decades-long journey to unravel the mystery of the novelist's writing, her life, and death. The English translation was published by Transit Books this April.
It's a fascinating story, and we're fortunate to have Mersal on the show today to tell us all about it. So let's raid the stacks and get started.
Our guest today, Iman Mersal, is a poet, writer, academic, and translator. Born in the northern Egyptian Delta, she emigrated to Canada in 1999. Her book, Traces of Eniat, which was first published in Arabic in 2019, won the prestigious 2021 Sheikh Zayed Book Award, making her the first woman to win its literature category. The author of 5 books of Arabic poetry, her most recent poetry collection, The Threshold, won the 2023 National Translation Award and was shortlisted for the 2023 Griffin Poetry Award.
Iman, whom the New York Times recently called one of the most consequential Egyptian authors of her generation, is also the author of 2018's How to Mend, Motherhood and Its Ghosts. And her work has appeared in the Paris Review, the New York Review of Books, and The Nation, among other publications. She is an associate professor of Arabic literature at the University of Alberta, Canada. Welcome to the show, Iman. We're so glad to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here as well.
Okay, Iman, can you take us back to the fall of 1993? That's 30 years after Izayet's death. And tell us more about how you came upon Love and Silence, because you initially thought it was written by someone else, right?
Yeah. I found a novel. It was a plain gray cover by a woman named Eniat Izayet. And I never heard this name, despite the fact that I studied Arabic literature. So the first thing came to my mind, she must be a younger sister or a cousin of a famous Egyptian novelist named Latifa Zayed. She published her first novel in 1960, Open Door, and the novel became a film 3 years later, was very famous, iconic writer. So I actually started to read Zayed novel thinking she is just a relative who tried her hand in writing. I was, of course, mistaken.
Okay, so you start reading the novel, Love and Silence. What's your response?
At the very beginning, I was taken by the whisper voice in the novel and the language, because Latifa Zayed set the formula of a good novel written by an Arab female writer in 20th century by writing Open Door 1960. So the formula was basically to have the women question and the nation question, and they have to be mingling together. There is no separation between women and nation. With Eniat Izayet novel, it started with a death of a brother of the narrator. So I thought, oh, she will take some time, you know, meditation with grief, and then she will go on to find this formula. But it wasn't actually. The novel was more complicated with so many layers. The language was very strange, as if she is translating from another language. This is what fascinates me the most. She was not trained in Arabic literature to begin with. She studied in German school, and her father used to sit with her daily to improve her Arabic language in terms of writing. So you can see the struggle in her writing. And what I want readers to know about the novel when it's translated into English. Now there is a project that it will be translated, is really the language of the novel. In this particular moment, a female writer is trying to put this internal journey in Arabic language. I don't treat really this novel as memoir at all, but you can see that it was typical of her journey, actually. Anxiety, depression, feeling alienated inside her own class, inside her own body. The novel is not the best novel you would read, of course, and it's a debut novel. So it has all of the problems of debut novel when the young writer wants to capture and to say everything, you know. However, there is this kind of genuine voice that for me was a great gift. I really did not read in Arabic a female voice like this until I read Love and Silence in 1993.
And I just want to go back to that moment, like you're in the bookshop, you find this book, you pick it up, it's totally unknown, and yet it's this voice when you read it that is completely unlike anything you've read. It's amazing.
And unfortunately for all of us English speakers, we have to wait a little while to get a copy of this. It's good to hear that this is going to be translated at some point, but I'll go ahead and read an excerpt from Love and Silence. Out of the still calm of sleep, I pulled myself into motion, wandered across the room, and standing by the window, brushed my discontent into the street. I sat down, looked out, paged through the book of life. My heart was heavy, and to my eyes, everything seemed old. People were damp, yellow leaves, and I was unmoved by them, by their faces, by the soft covers of their clothes. I felt at once imprisoned by this life and pulled towards new horizons. I wanted to pull this self clear, gummy with the sap of its surroundings, to tear free into a wider world. The clear skies of my country bored me. I wanted others, dark and muddied and threatening, capable of stirring fear and astonishment. I wanted my feet to know a different land.
I mean, gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
I really want to just comment here. So see this last sentence, to find a land, you know, not her homeland. This was in the time when the dominant discourse in culture talking about the homeland, the nation, the best land ever, the most brilliant nation ever, and so on and so forth. I just want to say, when you read something like this in this age, in this environment, and you feel it's as if it's really speaking to you directly.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it's how I felt. I still do feel sometimes, but definitely felt really strongly in my 20s and, you know, my late teens. It's a beautiful way of putting it that I never could have, but that feeling of just wanting another experience so deeply, and also that ambivalent feeling of discontent, but also excited about the potential future at the same time. And it, yeah, exactly. So I thought that was lovely. And your translations throughout the book, because that's our opportunity to get to hear her voice, are just wonderful. So I'm so glad that you wove them throughout your book.
Okay, so you're realizing right away, wait a second, this is a whole different ball game here, and probably, possibly not what I thought, not a relative of this other very iconic writer. What information then were you able to uncover on Izayet in your first attempts at research?
Right away, actually, I started to ask older writers whom I know from the 60s generation, and I was very close to, I started to ask them about a woman named Ainet Izayet or about the novel. And I was so taken back that people did not know her. And when someone knows her, they would tell me very interesting things like her mother is German, or she had to learn Arabic language in order to write in Arabic. One time someone told me, oh, she is absolutely the younger sister of Latifa Zayed, going back to my, you know, assumption. And this actually made me ask my first question. And it wasn't who is Ainet Zayed. It was, why this novel has been excluded from the canon of Arabic literature, from lists about Arab female writers, 60s writing, whatever. So this was the first question, actually. What makes the canon celebrate or exclude or forget something?
Right, right. So this all sparked what eventually turned out to be this decades-long quest to learn more about Ayzat. And I want to read from your book, Traces of Eniat. In it, you write, "There's a kind of intense curiosity which possesses us when we encounter an author who is truly unknown, a branch cut from the tree with no date of birth or death in evidence, or when their writing offers no clues to the wider life of their generation, to their close friends or literary influences." I really love the use of the word clues here, because I felt like your book is just this beautifully written real-life mystery. Like a detective, you're sifting through all this evidence. It's often contradictory. As you said earlier, it's incomplete. And there's also this physicality to the search. You're digging through archival material. You're reaching out to Ayzat's friends and family. You're meeting some of them in person multiple times throughout this search. And you're even traversing the streets of Cairo, particularly its cemeteries. And I found that part especially interesting. I was Googling to see pictures of the cemeteries and learning more about how they're part of life there. I wanted to know if you could share something about that with our listeners so they can get a feel for that as well.
Sure. Let me tell you first about geography in the book, because I really felt when you search for someone and this person is absent in the official public archive and her family got rid of so many things, including the draft of her second novel, as we can talk about later. When you are searching for almost a ghost, it was for me geography that I can rely on. I want to know where did she live and died, worked, and where is her cemetery. And here, a new relation merged with Cairo, because I left Cairo in 1998. Of course, I go every year, but every year you go, places are disappearing, changing, and so on. But through the search for Eniat, I started to see the map of Cairo differently. So, for example, to find her old house in Cairo, I found out that I was living just two streets down from there in Doki neighborhood. But the neighborhood was a bourgeoisie neighborhood, full of villas, trees, and very fancy during Eniat life. But during my life, it became middle-class area, crowded, full of open markets in the streets and so on. The cemetery was very important for so many reasons. I mean, I love what Cydia Hartman said about visiting archive. She said to visit an archive is to go into a morgue. What do we see in morgue? You see corpses. You see corpses that can't speak for themselves. She was buried in what is known as the city of the dead, right? It's more than 4 miles of different cemeteries and mausoleums, beautiful ones. However, with urbanizations, poverty, migration from villages to big Cairo, people started to live there. So when you walk there, you are seeing people living there, children playing, you hear music, you smell food. So you can't see life and death coming that close to each other in anywhere, I think, like this cemetery. However, I ended the book promising Eniat that I will visit her again and again. This is her place, the only place I am sure she is in. But guess what? 2020, our government had a plan to build so many bridges and highways. And part of doing this was to demolish some of these beautiful cemeteries, which means even cemeteries are threatened to disappear.
There's just so much symbolism there.
I know. I was just going to say, it's so in keeping with Eniat's story.
Exactly.
It just keeps happening time and again. And also these coincidences between her life and yours. You mentioned living in close proximity, but there's so many throughout the course of your book that kind of give you chills. Mm-hmm. It took you so long to work this all out that it was almost like time was giving you little morsels here and there, or Eniat was slowly dispensing the information to you. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I agree. So let's go back to Aziat's life. What can you tell us about her early life, her childhood, her family?
Her childhood can be seen through images, right? So from her sister, Azima Zayed, who died actually last year, it was about happy childhood, a devoted father, intellectual father, bourgeoisie family. The mother is Turkish, a little bit tough and controlling. From Nadia Lotfi, the iconic Egyptian actress who was close friend to Anayat Zayed, it wasn't that happy. Yes, the father was devoted, and Anayat was very close to her father, but she actually did not get along with her mother because her mother was applying the bourgeoisie rules, and Anayat was struggling with depression, interested in writing and painting, not in salons and showing off. So whatever happiness and, you know, functionality of the family were there, she was struggling as a child, sure.
So you mentioned Nadia Lotfi. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got in touch with Nadia and what she told you about their friendship?
So Nadia Lotfi is this kind of actress. She's an icon. I mean, think about Audrey Hepburn or something. We used to watch her movies in TV and in cinema since I was a child. So the idea of reaching out to her was just terrifying. So I actually called the number I got from a friend who is a journalist. And I did not expect her to answer. But she answered. She has this horsey voice because she was a heavy smoker. So I know she is Nadia Lotfi right away. And we talked for 1 hour in this first phone call. And later on, I went to Egypt and I kept meeting her at least twice a year or so. And we continued talking and we would drink lots of whiskey, smoke lots of cigars together, stay up until almost the morning. And she was sending me with her driver home, you know. So every time I was with her, I just would feel, I can't believe it. This is Nadia Lotfi.
Listeners, it's like Angelina Jolie or somebody like that, and finding out that she has this childhood friend who's a lost lady of literature and is going to tell me all about it and how intimidated you would be, but also how wild and crazy this must have been for you.
I mean, it's like Eniat led you to her.
Didn't Nadia say the same thing?
Yes. She said she sent you to me. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so let's move on in Eniat's story a little bit. She married an Air Force pilot at a very young age. She wanted to sort of get away from her childhood. And so she thought marriage was the answer. It was not, to say the least. What do you know, Iman, from your research about this marriage?
It was a wrong decision. She was not happy. They were completely different. She felt suffocated, as she wrote in her diary more than once. She asked for divorce. And actually, the whole thing was solved after a few years, not by the court, but by her father speaking directly to the husband and convincing him to divorce him.
Okay, so she's separated from her husband, as you said. She's living in her father's house. There's an apartment on the floor above his, I believe it's an apartment. She's sharing custody of her young son with her husband. So this hasn't been resolved. What's going on there?
In terms of custody, the father had the right to have full custody of the son when he reached age 6. This was the law then. And the son was coming closer to this age, of course. So Abbas Zayed, Anayat's father, built this beautiful villa in Doki. And when she wanted to leave her husband and ask for divorce, he built another apartment above the villa so she can have her independent life. And this is the space where she wrote Love and Silence. This is the space where she dreamed of obtaining Optima machine so she can type. It was very new trend. So she got one to type her novel. So what I'm trying to say is there are so many gaps to describe this 3 years and a half before her suicide. But we can fill these gaps by imagining her geography without really speaking for her. Like, I mean, in the end, you are imagining. I don't want the question of why did Anayat commit suicide to be in the center of my book, really, it wasn't. Maybe at the beginning, I wanted to know. And I was fascinated with the idea that a young woman with a son, a beloved father, a friend like Nadia Lotfi would commit suicide because her novel is rejected. I felt it's a tragedy, but it's a very interesting tragedy. It deserves to be known and searched. So I think really the rejection of the novel was the last straw. Her identity was a writer and a mother, and both were going to be taken from her. She did not live really to her potential.
The lack of archival information that was available on her did seem to impact how you thought about your own legacy as a writer and what you leave behind. You talked about that a little bit in your book.
Yeah, I mean, you go through stages in this case. One of them is, oh, I want to keep my archive, my old papers and diaries and, you know, drafts of books and blah, blah, blah. And you go to your father's house, collect it, and so on and so forth. But seriously, through my experience with the NIL, I feel now at least that the best way to protect our archive is to read other people's archives, is to read the past. We read the past not to display it, not to talk about, for example, Anayat as a victim. No, she is not a victim. I was celebrating all the time the potential of Anayat as well. But it's actually to find this intersection and the connection between you and the others. It could be a historical event. It could be a person. It could be a place. I don't know. But reading the past is our great way of actually reading the archive. Because if you go to the archive without a question, without a burning question, you will display it. You will talk about the interesting things about an ad, for example. It's not that way. I was actually reading my own archive while writing about an ad. This is how I think about it.
I love the way you put that.
You also have a really interesting section towards the end of your book. It's almost an aside where you address all these other women writers from the past and you talk to them individually. And then you say, I want to tell a story right now. I want to light a candle for Anayat. And I want to talk about the day she decided that life was unbearable. That was such a beautiful and poignant section of your book. And I think it kind of ties into what you just said about reading the past.
Yeah, it's usually really the question of how to tell a story, either it's our story or someone else's story. So talking about this chapter, I was almost visualizing every day the last few days of Anayat life. But how to write it is just so difficult. Am I going to write it as a prophet who saw what happened or someone who is imagining? I felt the heavy weight of reaching this moment of a young woman standing in front of mirror, desperate, feeling I don't want to be here anymore. And then a moment happened that it's January 3rd. I'm in bed already. And then you realize it's Anayat, you know, birthday. I went to my studio behind the house and then something opened up. I saw actually all of these books because I was searching them as well of female writers older than Anayat. Next to here in my big desk. And this is the moment when you feel so connected to the past. It's not just Anayat. It's not just, it's all of these women here. They existed. Lots of them are forgotten. And it's a moment to celebrate one of them. So it's really finding the way to tell a story is always the most fascinating thing in writing. So.
Yeah, I love that moment of like, it just all came together for you when you saw the books. Yeah. I feel like we haven't done her writing enough justice yet on this episode. And so I want to read another passage from her journals. There wasn't much available from her journals, right? Mm-hmm. But this passage that you included in your book just stopped me in my tracks. I'll preface it by saying that Anayat, she would often refer to herself in the third person in her diaries. So this is her talking about her decision to get married when she was young. She entered a marriage without love, without mutual understanding, without compatibility. The possibility of such things had never occurred to her. Her only thought was to escape the discipline and constraints of school. So the paradise of infancy closed its gates and the doors of a premature young adulthood swung open. Young adulthood? Just adulthood. And she chose wrong. She went through the wrong door, the one that opened onto a desert, onto wastelands devoid even of mirages. And she looked back to find that the door had vanished, and now there was no way home that she could see. Bewildered, she wept. Wretched and lost, she wept. And then she took heart and resigned herself, and in doing so discovered an extraordinary capacity to endure. She saw herself as a camel, ruminating on all the happy moments of the past, chewing them over slowly, slowly, in the midst of that brutal desert. And then the provisions ran out. The past was finished, and the camel needed something new to chew on, but there was nothing to be had except despair, yellow as the sands. And her body wasted away, and her soul thinned, and she began to call for deliverance, began to scream for help. Suddenly, she saw that her home was built on shifting sands, and the harder she worked to save it, the deeper and deeper it sank. And she pleaded for salvation, for help from God, from fate, from everything. Caught up in her wild inquiry, she had forgotten that no one was coming to save her because she was the only one who could do it. The first impulse must be hers. Then she saw the key of deliverance that hung at her neck and in her soul, in the spirit within her. And so she rose to her feet and, opening the door, she stood on the threshold and filled her lungs with life, with the rich fragrance of youth, the scent of spring and freedom. There on the threshold, she cast off her old cracked hide, gashed and knotted, saturated with fear, and took her first steps in new skin, free and uninhibited. She was brave. She was steadfast. She relied on herself. I mean, I cannot wait to read this novel, Love and Silence, based on that passage alone from her diary. If this is how she was writing, I know you're saying it's not the greatest novel ever, but this writing right here is pretty damn good.
And this is really what makes literature great. I mean, you don't have to write the best novel in the earth, but you can talk about a work that has really impact on you, that can speak to you. And this is what we should appreciate about literature, actually, more than anything else. Yeah.
Absolutely. Izayet died on January 3rd, 1963. And you imagine her final day in Traces of Eniat, but we'll never truly know exactly what happened. We do know that she left a note to her son and took an overdose of pills. It was 4 years after her death that Love and Silence was finally published. How did that happen, and what was the response to the book?
Eniat's father and Nadia tried to publish the novel more than once, and they kept waiting for this publishing house to bring the book out. When the book came out, it was March 1967. Some, actually, of our best critics at the time wrote about the novel and how beautiful it is and how sad that the novelist is dead. And I got to know this later when I started the archival search. However, 1967 war took place in June, like 3 months after the novel was published. And if you go through not just the Egyptian, Arab newspaper from the war and for at least a year, everything was about the defeat, was about the war, what about what's next. It was barely available to see any even book review in these newspapers and magazines. So I think there was kind of bad luck, but also the question for me was really why this novel did not impact other Arab female writers of the time. They kept using the formula of women, nation, big issues and so on. I think it wasn't included in the literary scene. It wasn't talking about enough. It wasn't taught in schools like other novels and so on.
You discovered, as you briefly mentioned earlier, that there was a second novel in the works, and that
adds really to the sense of loss there. What do you know about that novel?
So in Aeneid diary, or to be like specific, in the independent separated papers that survived from her diary, there was actually two or three pages that I didn't understand at the beginning at all. She wrote the name of Ludwig Keimer with another two German names. When I searched them, Ludwig Keimer was a very famous Egyptologist who was born 1892 in Germany, and he escaped in 1928 to come and live in Egypt. And he lived in Egypt until he died in 1957. And just a year after he came to Egypt, he became involved in the culture and the Egyptology scene in Egypt with other scholars. So he was involved in cataloging the National Egyptian Museum. He got the Egyptian national citizenship and so on and so forth. So the name was just a mystery for me. But there was also more than one address in her diaries that didn't make any sense. And with my search, I was successfully connecting the address to Keimer and to his other German friends. So when it came to my attention that she was writing a novel about Keimer, I became absolutely all over the place searching for any draft. I found actually some pieces of the draft of the novel. And I kept imagining that Aeneid was trying to do with Ludwig Keimer exactly what I am doing with her now. So when she worked in the German Institute of Antiquities, she was bored, actually. She felt it's a useless job, but I have to take it. She used to make fun of herself as a woman who is working in bookshelves. But actually, she became so fascinated with his life because this guy had a great collection of books, manuscripts, paintings, maps. And the institute bought all of his materials. And his collection was just amazing. And she was working in classifying this material since she knows German. So she became fascinated with his life. So I think this was a potential to go out of your crisis, right? And through Keimer's life, I imagine that she was trying to reposition herself in her own life. She didn't finish the novel.
Right. His story was an escape for her. Yeah.
Yes. The story of lonely Jewish intellectuals and scholars in Egypt is just fascinating. All of those who escaped the Nazi to come, and they became really part of the society, important part of the society. Every one of them needs a book. Yeah, but we wish someone would write about
it. How much time do you have, Iman? How much time do you have?
I don't. It's not my project, but
okay.
But I feel really like sometimes I have this feeling, especially in Cairo, because it's my city. I feel if I move a stone in the street, I will find a story. So it's not about the interesting stories. It's about which stories is really part of you to tell, because it takes years. You are right. To tell one story. Every time you start the project, you are 60 pages into a draft, and then you feel it. No, this is not what I want to do. Like walking in a street and you find a wall in front of you and you have to repoot. And I'm actually engaged with Aeneid because of poetry, because this is what touched me in her whispering voice, is this kind of poetic power. And I'm asking my questions about her, but I don't want to speak for her. So it's not biography. It's not an academic work. It's not a history book, right? It's everything together. I wasn't able to write the book until it came to me one enlightening second that the story of my search for Aeneid is a book, not a particular genre. And I will have freedom to go with whatever genre that can express what I want to say. And this was a moment that the book is really opened itself.
I think you chose perfectly in that it's so much more interesting than just reading a cut and dry biography of what you could find about her life. And the missing pieces almost spurned you on to have to get creative in that way. And when you're talking about writing and hitting a wall, hitting a dead end, that literally was happening to you in Cairo. You were trying to look for her childhood home and being like, wait, the street's not here. And having to talk to doormen and figure out where's the street now? Because it moved. So it's yes. It's very fascinating to read your book. I absolutely loved it.
Same. Thank you. Definitely. Thank it's you. A wonderful book.
So we hope that there's a renewed interest in Eniat Izayat, thanks to your book, Iman. And Kim and I are both so glad that through her, we've been introduced to your work. Listeners, there are so many intriguing twists and turns to Iman's journey in telling Eniat's story. It's quite a ride and well worth reading. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We truly appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to get to talk to you and talk about this wonderful book. So that's all for today's show. Thanks for joining us. And we invite you next week to listen to our Patreon episode on Ina Eloise Young. She was one of America's first female sports reporters and likely the first sports editor of a daily American newspaper.
I will also be fangirling a little over Caitlin Clark in that episode and recounting my own brief history as a sports reporter. If you want to get in on that and all of our twice monthly bonus episodes, go to lostladiesoflit.com and click Become a Patron. And shout out to our newest Patreon members, Simon Slayton and Julia Valentine. Thank you for your support.
Our theme song was written and performed by Jenny Malone, and our logo was designed by Harriet Grant. Lost Ladies of Lit is produced by Kim Askew and Amy Helms and made possible by listeners like you.